The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. Dust thou art, and unto dust shall you return. Anything scientific about that? Maybe you've called men a clod before. But do you realize how earthy we really are? People take a look at the statements in the book of Genesis, and they say that's about the most unscientific language they ever heard. But wait just a minute. Back in the book of Genesis is the so-called story, as people like to put it, of creation. The story of a man called Adam, the story of the Garden of Eden, the story of a man and a woman running around in the proverbial fig leaves and the beginning of the creation. And of course today, one of the most widespread notions and ideas, a concept that permeates all of higher education, of philosophy, and even religion to a great and a growing extent, is the idea of evolution. And of course, millions of people take great exception to the story of Adam and Eve in the garden. And they say, oh, surely you don't believe in that, do you? The notion today is that we just happened. That we're cosmic accidents of some type, lost in the corner of a galaxy of millions of stars among millions of other galaxies, drifting along on this Earth of ours without plan or purpose, living our accidental lives, dying in accidents, never having known why we were here in the first place and what our journey through life was all about. But is it unscientific to say that you are made of the dust, the dirt, and the earth of the ground? Well, I'm going to show you on this program, as I said it would last time, that when you go right back to the earth, the soil of this earth, you find one of the most epic stories, one of the most fantastic revelations about life and the beginnings of life that you could possibly come to understand. And you will find, by listening to just a few simple facts about it, that statement, dust thou art, in the old King James language, in other words, here was one, the Bible claims to be God, who was talking to the conscious man, Adam, and the name Adam merely meant red clay or red mud. Actually, it's a Hebrew word that merely means a clod, a blob of earth. And so this great creator being, if you can believe in that, and of course you can if you want to prove it to yourself, said, you are, Adam, a clod, and you're going to return to the clods. You are a gob of earth, of the sandy, loamy soil from which you came, and you're going to decompose and go right back to that soil. Now, evolution cannot be proved. It can't be demonstrated. It's absolutely shot through and riddled with terribly contradictory, illogical thinking and many, many errors, and it can be disproved, and I've been doing just exactly that in a series of broadcasts on The World Tomorrow that I've called The Seven Proofs That God Exists. And a summary article on that subject will come along automatically with the booklet, Does God Exist?, which we can send to you by return mail absolutely free of charge, hitting the high spots of these seven major proofs that there is a great God. And one of the great proofs that that God does exist is the fact of the sustaining of all life. And breaking it down, the balance, the interdependency, the harmony of all life. You know, to tell you that there is a giant epic struggle going on in the soil that you might pick up in a teaspoon or between your thumb and forefinger sounds a little odd until you find out just what I mean by that. You're living, as it were, on the rooftops of a hidden world, because beneath the soil surface there is a land of absolute fascination, of incredible mysteries, a fascinating, gripping story, and one of the greatest disproofs of the theory of evolution. The apparent lifelessness of Earth that you pick up and crumble between your fingers is actually a terrible illusion, because there are there specks of protoplasm swarming through soil granules invisible to your naked eye. Larger animals and plants are linked to them by invisible threads of food supply and living conditions. And similar to this, there are interlocking relationships between these larger creatures, plant and animal, and so up the pyramid until you come to the apex, which is the fabric of life itself. But here are bacteria and viruses and nematodes and all these little organic creatures, the very fabric of life. And the abundance of life in plain dirt is staggering. Now, the organisms that are there vary from submicroscopic up to the relatively gigantic, like the largest invertebrate of all, the earthworm. And that's a million times the size of the smallest one visible to the naked eye, the mite. And the mite is a million times larger than the smallest soil animal, which is a protozoan. And a protozoan would look like a giant alongside a virus. Now, in numbers, the soil ranges from billions to the ounce to only a handful of some of these species per acre. And they carpet the particles of soil and weave a way through them. Now, here's just a type of comparison you might get. A Dr. William Beebe of the New York Zoological Society found that even in a teaspoon of soil from the temperate regions of the earth, there may be as many as 5 billion bacteria, 20 million anomasates, a million protozoa, and 200,000 algae and fungi. Now, these giant crowds, these huge gangs of microorganisms carry on such fierce activity per acre that they expend an amount of energy equal to 10,000 human beings living and working in 1 acre of soil. Now, to show you their growth rate, and here's a fantastic question for evolution, how could any of them have evolved separately? You know, evolution goes along with the notion that at one time or another, each form of life ruled the earth. That there was a time, for example, when flies ruled the world, and I guess it came time for cockroaches to do it. Now, it's all a little funny when you begin to analyze it in the light of cold, sheer logic as to how can they, what could they have eaten, but to go back to the soil, here's what actually would happen. You see, in the soil, there's a tremendous balance. The preyers, or the ones who are preyed upon, and the ones who are preying upon, the ones who are eating and the ones who are being eaten. And these are tiny links in far-reaching and complex food chains. Now, it's such a good thing that there is such a balance of control between each of these organisms, because a single bacterial cell produces a new generation every 20 minutes. And in only 2 days, this bacterial cell could, theoretically, give rise to 24 trillion trillion bacteria, an amount equal, listen to this, to 4,000 times the weight of the earth itself, in 2 days' time. But fortunately, I guess you should use that term, science often does, because there are other organisms that are preying upon them and keep them in a very delicate balance. Myriads of these microbes are consuming one another, and they have to be present because nothing else is going to consume them. And if that isn't true, then there could be no other form of life on the earth but a giant, teeming, sort of a microscopic army of bacteria weighing more than 4 times the earth itself in 2 days. And it would go on to explosive proportions and all die out and start all over again and so on. So it's a fantastic balance. Now, an example of just how that balance works in one case. It rains. You look at the dirt growing muddy. All right, the rain fills the spaces between the soil particles. And oxygen down into the earth, which you need to have aerated and tilled up and disturbed in your garden, is cut off. Now, suddenly this whole microbial world undergoes a giant transformation. Most bacteria demand oxygen. And these forms become inert. But in their place, other kinds begin to flourish. And these are called anaerobes, similar because they can multiply in the complete absence of oxygen. So the protozoa awaken from their protective little cysts and decimate these hordes of advancing bacteria, swimming through the new underground lakes and picking off all the dying game. Sounds like a war, doesn't it? Well, that's about what it is. Going on in that pinch of soil you pick up, that teaspoon of soil, is a giant acting and interacting chain of life, an epic struggle that remains in complex balance. Now, as these protozoa swim along through these new little underground lakes of microscopic proportions of raindrop size, picking off all the dying game, a few of the billions somehow manage to survive this storm, and the minute it's over, they're ready to repopulate their bit of earth when all these floodwaters, tiny raindrops, recede. Now, in the soil, as in the forest, as in the area of humankind eating vegetables and flesh, no life form is sufficient unto itself. There are many and varied patterns that are woven by these various little inhabitants, and it's quite a story. It's one of the greatest disproofs of all evolution. Which came first? The one that is preying upon the other one, or the one that is being preyed upon? The one cannot live without the other. They are interacting. Let me make it plain. The interrelationship of these creatures couldn't be any more complex than that of a clostridium wedded to two bacterial partners which remove the oxygen from its tiny little clod-bound atmosphere, leaving it only the nitrogen it needs. Now, these protozoa, which have been sheltered inside the stomachs of termites, each partner is doing for the other something that it cannot achieve alone. Here are termites, but they can't exist, and they can't break down and eat and even decompose solid wood out here in these forests and fly about from place to place and cause the decomposition of wood, unless they have certain protozoa and bacteria inside their stomachs, which came first. The only place these protozoa and bacteria can exist is in the stomach of a termite. A horrible place to be, I agree with you, but nevertheless, the place that this particular type of bacteria must be. And the only thing they can help this little creature break down and decompose is wood. But how did that wood get started? Because the wood can't grow unless all these various other types of bacteria exist to create a life chain in the soil to allow this tree to pull nitrogen out of the air and the soil and to follow the process of photosynthesis to produce oxygen for air-breathing creatures and to pull all of the various nutrients out of the soil. Well, you observe life underfoot, and you have to do so either with the naked eye and some of the very larger specimens or through a microscope. You can't fail to observe the endless variety of these partnerships have been entered into. Many of the plants and animals have joined their resources and created completely new entities. For instance, on the subject of tree roots and nitrogen, you find out what's been happening in the formation of nitrogen, the taking of nitrogen from the air, and it's one of the most unbelievable stories you have ever read in all of your life. Now, the air all over the globe, every acre of the globe, if you could break it down that way, contains more than 36,000 tons of nitrogen. The Germans, back in World War I, by the Haber process, managed to figure a way to take nitrogen out of the air, because that's where it is. And, of course, you've heard of this liquid nitrogen that is manufactured chemically that farmers use to spray on their soil. As to whether that's good or not, well, that's something to research for you, but I'll give you a clue. You can't manufacture it chemically and put it in the soil in the same way that little tiny nodules on roots of growing legumes can do. Let me tell you about it. Nitrogen does not usually combine into suitable compounds for plants to absorb through their roots. But bacteria in the soil, which are vital to the existence of life, are found on the roots of these legumes. And this is plants such as the clover in your lawn or mostly peas and beets and soybeans. Now, these bacteria are the primary fixers of nitrogen from the atmosphere, and they can produce as many as 200 pounds of it to the acre every single year. This is a life process that is going on of these little bacteria, which exist in little nodules on roots of legumes, pulling nitrogen out of the air, putting it into the soil by their partnership with the roots of this plant. So their job is a vitally necessary one, and you couldn't live without it. Now, as far back as the ancient Roman Empire, they began to observe some of these things. Way back among the ancient Romans, they found out that these various legumes, the plants that I've mentioned, like peas and beans and soybeans, have unusual, funny-looking structures that resemble kind of like warts or galls on their roots. And it was found out by Roman farmers way back B.C., that growing legumes on worn-out lands would restore fertility. They didn't know why, but they merely told one another that if you'll plant peas or soybeans on this plot of ground, next year it'll do a lot better. It wasn't until down in 1837 that experiments led them to the amazing conclusion that these legumes, such as clover, are somehow able to take nitrogen out of the air. Romans didn't know what nitrogen was. But the problem still appeared absolutely insurmountable because nobody could visualize how the plant might accomplish this feat. About 50 years later, researchers began to suspect that it wasn't the plants themselves that were doing all this with the nitrogen, but an unusual little wart or nodule on the root. And they came to find through a microscope that each one of these little warts on these roots are filled with millions of bacteria, and that each nodule contains only a particular strain of a particular bacterium. And also, each one of these bacterium is attracted only to a certain kind of plant and no other. And that the one cannot exist without the other. And that both of them together in a unique bacterium and plant partnership are able to take nitrogen out of the air and put it into the soil. Now, neither the plant nor the bacteria alone can achieve this nitrogen fixation. The bacteria just wandering around through the soil can't do it. The plant without the bacteria forming little nodules on the roots can't do it. And even when the bacteria are taken directly from the nodules, they can't do it. The growing plant has to serve the bacteria carbohydrates and energy in the form of sugars from the plant. And the bacteria take the nitrogen from the air and make it available to the plant. And together they form a remarkable team. Which came first, these little busy bacteria? Did they rule the earth at some time? Well, balderdash and falderall. Ridiculous and illogical. It's impossible. My friends, you can apply these things to any aspect of life, from the bacteria that make you digest your food in your own stomach and intestinal system, on down to the cells that carry oxygen to the cells in your blood, the blood cells and corpuscles that carry food and oxygen to your little finger. The one cannot exist without the other. What are all these little living organisms all around us? You look at a little handful of dirt, and what you've got here is an epic struggle of epic proportions of all kinds of forces that are living upon each other. Now, among the soil bacteria, you find the greatest fracturing factories on the face of the earth. They're able to break down anything. All the vegetation of the grasslands every year passes back to the soil. There's a yearly process. You look in the spring, it's green. In the fall, it's brown. In the winter, it's not there. What happened to it? Bacteria got it. And the primary agents of decay are these bacteria. You almost think of a little wee beastie with hair all over his body and giant teeth and a huge jutting jaw. Well, they don't look like that. They're just little kind of quivering blobs, kind of forming chains or little tiny quivering, various funny-shaped pieces of life. But they can break down a tremendous range of materials and use them as foodstuffs, and some of them can break down even some that man, using elaborate arrays of equipment and very high temperatures and all that, have difficulty doing in the laboratories. And chemists have been feeding these bacteria all type of complex materials, such as don't even exist in the natural world, combinations of materials that scientists have put together chemically. And they found that these bacteria are experts in even fracturing and decomposing these chemically manufactured fragments, including, mind you, some of the very strongest poisons that are concocted to kill the bacteria themselves. So what do? Well, they just adjust to this, and they get busy, and they break down that stupid poison and put it back into the soil, eventually, in some harmless form. Now, of course, at first, they have a terrible time, and it kills off nearly all of them and everything else, and maybe you too, if you're not careful. But eventually, these bacteria will begin to break it down. Now, the fungi are the most widespread microorganisms of the forest floor and the soil. And this is more the forest floor than it is a farming area, because these fungi bear the burden of decomposing the vast amounts of dead wood and the leaves that fall to the forest floor every year. Now, that's why in Germany, where they have the system of cutting full-growth timber off and then taking the area and grubbing all the roots up and then planting it to crops, and then they just rotate in a forestation program between vegetable and crop-producing soil and timber. And they have found that the forest floor, after you get it up, this humus and everything, is absolutely some of the best soil you can ever have. Now, the reason are these fungi. And the humus of the forest soil is made by fungi. And their growth through the soil is often so extensive that it actually will hold the soil particles in place. Now, it's known by scientists that there are many specialized fungi which take an active part in the life of the soil, and they do so in an orderly sequence. A recently dying root or dead root might first be attacked by a sugar fungus, which leads the way for a whole host of other fungi. You know, like they say, one root says to the other root, there's a fungus among us. And they look out because here comes some fungi to attack them. Now, each of these takes as its sphere of influence one of the substances that made up the root. But there's a certain sort of a pecking order, you might say. They wait in line, as it were. Like a bunch of chickens will do. There's a pecking order among chickens in a flock, you know. And there's an eating order among cows, sometimes. One cow's going to come in a barn before another every single time. You milk farmers know that. These old cattle figure out a way as to who's the boss. Well, now, isn't it amazing that even fungus have done the same thing? In the early stages of preparing a compost pile, if spores of the common mushroom are placed in it, they won't germinate. But after the heap has been sufficiently aged, these spores do germinate and a good crop results. And the reason is this, that this common mushroom spore is a lignin decomposer. It'll be able to break down and eat up woody or cellulose parts. And it's the last of a long series of these fungus specialists, and it has to wait its turn and then begin its work. Now, how do you figure that? How does evolution explain chickens of the soil with a pecking order among fungus? The fantastic balance in soil, that is the thing that they just cannot explain. I don't think they've ever tried, so far as that's concerned. I've never seen anything in evolution that tries to account for all of the fantastic complex interrelationship and interaction of bacteria and of the tiny little microorganisms in the soil and the food web, the food chain that exists in the soil between the air and the surface of the soil and what goes on down at the root level, and the fantastic food chain in the sea. No, they just deal with this imaginary idea that given enough time, anything can happen. They real quickly want to get from protozoans right on down to cellular animals and plants and then have them crawling out of the sea and becoming four-legged animals. Ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. And it won't hold water. One of the most ridiculous stories that's ever come along. Now, believe it or not, one of the most destructive pests on the face of the earth is a little character called a nematode. And what they do per year will stagger your imagination. Their yearly ravages cost American agriculture, a conservative estimate, of $500 million, but probably many times that amount, yet they don't have hands or arms. But nematodes are responsible for devastating 10% of our crops. They don't have any brains, and yet for centuries they've been outsmarting people. People can't outsmart these little critters. They don't know how to figure them. And to date, no more than one species in 10, and there are about 10,000 different species, stands convicted as even being harmful. But the bad ones, and they can't even discover which ones are currently plundering some 30 of our important crops. And development of chemical compounds strong enough to penetrate this nematode egg cysts without killing the plants to which they are attached is a prime challenge to the manufacturers of nematicides. Pesticides to kill nematodes. Now, some of these nematodes can be fatally trapped. But they're trapped not by man's chemicals, but by fungus cowboys who throw loops like lariats around them. Now, I have before me a picture, a fantastic microscopic picture of nematode snares on a microscopic fungus. And it has all kinds of loops that are lying here in wait. And here comes this scraggly, wormy-looking nematode along. And these loops are gaping open, and all of a sudden they grab him, and they snare him in little tiny hair-like snares, only a thousandth of an inch thick. The roots of these plants have them. The nematode is then strangled by various fungus filaments that invade it and kill it. A fantastic war is going on all the time in the soil. And people aren't aware of it. They've never studied it. The average housewife, when she walks out of the supermarket or the grocery store, doesn't have the remotest idea of what it took to get those carrots. What she sees is the manufacturer of the plastic bag. She probably sees the tinkling cash register and the gleaming grocery cart and the asphalt parking lot and her automobile and the buildings and the money that changes hands. But the fascinating, interesting story of how that carrot grew in the soil, the amazingly complex types of living creatures, the microscopic bacteria, the viruses, the fungi that perform all kinds of highly specialized functions to cause that root to grow and to convert the nutrients, the minerals, and the elements in the soil into a usable form so that she and her family, after they prepare it or even eat it raw with some of the dirt on it if you choose, can cause that to become a part of your living cellular composition. Isn't that a marvelous, isn't that a fantastic, breathtaking possibility? A miracle in itself? You can prove that God exists by investigating a chunk of dirt. Because that's where you came from, and that's what you are. and that's what you depend upon. You came from the soil. You are a part of the ground, and you're going to go right back to the ground. And unless there is a God who has a great purpose in your being, in the fact that you're an air-breathing, water-drinking, food-consuming human being, then you are, after all, just an accident. But, my friends, there is nothing even remotely accidental about any of the complex, intricate life forms around you. They are fantastic when you study them. There's no life that's sufficient to itself. Now, you know, it's very fortunate for you that nematodes have all kinds of enemies in the soil. And the very best ones are Throbitris, a type of a fungi that you can see under a microscope. And now, most of the time, they live peaceably. They don't do anything. They just go ahead and consume organic matter. But the minute a nematode is present, this fungus becomes a kind of a hunter. And it develops little loops that it sends out in all kinds of directions that soon resemble a kind of a crumpled piece of chicken wire. And each one of these loops is extremely sticky. And a wandering nematode quickly becomes fastened in it. It struggles to escape, and in doing so, this nematode brushes against more loops. In a few hours, it's tightly encased and strangled to death. Now, this one kind of fungus doesn't even develop these barbed wire-like loops until the nematodes are present. When they're present, it puts out these loops, just like sticky knobs and fish hooks and barbed wires. Now, another kind of a trap is made into a noose. Three cells of the fungus grow into a curved shape, gradually enlarge until they form a kind of a lasso. They're kind of like nematode killers or fungus cowboys. And they gradually form this lasso just large enough for the nematode to get its head into. And as soon as this happens, the rings expand, closing the opening so tightly that the constriction of the nematode's body can actually be seen under a microscope. The nematode is then strangled, and there's not the possibility of it escaping. You know, somebody ought to write a new song, Ghost Riders in the Earth, talking about these struggling little nematode stranglers. It's a fantastic story. It makes me want to show you a cartoon. Maybe I can, as from our cartoonist in the Plain Truth magazine. Maybe we could even write a song about ghost riders in the earth. But the point is, my friends, that you cannot explain these interrelated, fantastic little creatures, this giant epic struggle that is going on in the soil to give you life. You can't do it unless there was a great designer and there is a great sustainer, a great architect of all life, and this all had to come into existence at precisely the same instant. It is an utter impossibility that it could have happened gradually. It had to happen at once, in one creative instant. It did, and you can prove it. Now, write for these booklets. About time you began to research a little bit of this for yourself. On Does God Exist, and the one on the proof of the Bible. And be sure to get your name on the mailing list of the Plain Truth magazine and get these articles that go into it more technically with full-color pictures every single month. They're free of charge and no price. In the current number of the Plain Truth magazine is this article on A Whale of a Tale or the Dilemma of the Doubting Dolphins. It's about evolution and whether or not dolphins and toothed whales evolved. Also the article, What Colleges and Universities Do Not Tell You. And the article, What Do You Mean? The Unpardonable Sin. And the one on how prophecy comes alive in today's world news. These are free of charge. There is no price for them. And also request a booklet by the name of this program, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, What It Will Be Like. They are free. There is no follow-up. No request for money. If you write to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.